Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, Pack Your Knives listeners. This is Tom here. We've got some great news. We have Pack Your Knives merch. That's right. Go to bit.ly/PYK merch to get a sweet, comfy, delicious-looking t-shirt from our friends at Cotton Bureau. That's bit.ly/PYK merch, all lowercase. And for those who may be, I don't know, shivering in a tent somewhere outside of Denver, we've got Pack Your Knives hoodies too. So go to bit.ly/PYK merch and rep the show. Thanks for listening and supporting Pack Your Knives. Now let's get on with the program.
It's Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, the season is off the rails. I just want to go over everything that has happened in the last, like, episode and a half, two episodes. There is no more Joe Flynn. There is no more Chef Fati. Joe Sasto has cooked 6 shitty dishes in a row. I have nobody left on my fantasy team in the actual competition. And by the way, Chef Carey is like the LeBron James of Top Chef. Like, these are just some of the many things that are happening in this, I think, one of the weirdest seasons in recent memory.
And not only that, Kevin, your Wi-Fi at the hotel you're at has cut out. And so you are working, you know, just like Carrie did with the oven in the snow in Denver. You are trying to...
I'm underneath, like, Peace Street in Washington, D.C. right now in a manhole tunnel. That's where I am at right now. I'm like her. I'm like cooking... I'm making omelets right now in the dark under the red line in the Washington Metro. That's where I'm at.
Kevin, you have no contestants left. Zero.
I have zero contestants.
I looked this up, Kevin. You are on a 7-game losing streak here. 7 times in a row, one of your contestants is gone. So let me just run through this real quick.
My season has approximated the Memphis Grizzlies season. Yes.
Yes. You've had 7 straight eliminations. Fatima, Joe Flam, Claudette, who you traded for and then got ousted. Tanya, brother, Leanne, who left the show, and 2. Starting with Tyler, you have gone on a 7-game losing streak. What has gone on with the chemistry on your team, Kevin?
I don't know. We're bringing in the psychometrics people. We're bringing in, like, all kinds of triage, because right now, I mean, what happens? You're the commissioner. Like, what happens when one of the two contestants, the two contestants being you and me, doesn't actually have any competitors left in the Top Chef competition?
Well, as per our offhand policy. I have not watched this week's Last Chance Kitchen. So right now, as far as we know, Claudette is out. Brother is in. Joseph Flam is in. Fatima is in on Last Chance Kitchen. And they are going to go to the death to go on to the next round of Last Chance Kitchen. So you have three potential chefs. I don't have any in Last Chance Kitchen. You have three potential ones. Who are you most rooting for at this point between Fati, Joe, and Brother to continue on and re-enter the competition?
I don't really. Beggars can't be choosers. I mean, obviously, Chef Fati is my sentimental favorite and would love to see her back in the competition. But I'm a big, you know, I like all those folks. I want to talk about Carrie for a second. To somehow also distract you from the fact that I can't talk about my fantasy team anymore, I do want to talk about Carrie, who, by the way, was drafted after, like, Kwame. Like was drafted so low in the draft, the expectations for her success so meager, that she was chosen behind people who were literally in the loser's bracket at the moment of the draft.
I'm trying to think. Is this like the Phoenix Suns when Jeff Hornacek was the coach, when everyone thought they were going to tank with the 76ers a couple years ago and they ended up with 51 wins and just missed the playoffs? Is that what Carey is? Is that the right comp here in the NBA?
I'm trying to figure out what she is. I mean, maybe the 60-win Atlanta Hawks? I mean, I don't know. Because one of the interesting things about her as a chef is she has been perceived to be so unambitious at times. Last week, a kale salad. This week, for the elimination quickfire. By the way, that is rough, elimination quickfire. She comes in with a toast. She's going to throw some arugula and goat cheese, and maybe, okay, we're going to steep some lavender in oil and throw some honey in, and that's going to basically stave off elimination. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And yet she does this every week. She defines the limits of her project, yet she achieves within her own constraints. She knows who she is as a chef. She wins with balance. She wins with aroma. She's not going to overthink it. Everybody gives her shade, but she also knows just what enough quirk to throw in there, right? Like the raisined beet last week, in the kale salad. I won't say I wouldn't call that an elevation, but it was there's enough of a novelty factor that she escapes the rap of, oh, a toast, oh, a kale salad. She's one of the most interesting chef contestants to come through this show in the last several seasons. Meanwhile, is she the favorite at this point?
I mean, right now in our scoring system, Kevin, she has 72 points. No one else has more than 45. The second place person in our fantasy scoring system is Joe Stash at 43 points, and Carrie almost doubles that. This week she got 25 points for winning not just the quickfire but also being on the winning team in the elimination challenge with also a pretty standard dish. Like, it's not very inventive to do green chili poutine.
No, I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about the Super Bowl challenge and sort of, I think, everybody thinking they had to dumb down everything and go with this tailgate food. And then the process essentially creating a bunch of bad dishes and no great ones. But you know, Carrie's interesting. She finished low the first week. Since then, she's got two wins, including this week. She has two high finishes. She's won the last two quick fires.
Juggernaut.
So, Juggernaut, I mean, Bruce is obviously still playing well. I know he technically finished low this week, but he cooked a pretty good, I think, skirt steak in the Super Bowl competition. But, I mean, you know, it's funny. I mean, Joe Sasto, we're talking, like, I pretty much had him penciled in as the most creative chef on the show and the guy to beat down below. He's cooked six crappy dishes in a row, starting with the three he did as the line cook or as the non-executive chef in Restaurant Wars. Comes out, does a terrible squash blossom, does buffalo cauliflower that any other week would have him off the show,
yep.
And then comes in with the fried mac and cheese, which isn't good, contributes to otherwise unsuccessful dishes that belong to Adrian. I mean, there's just
he's hit a rut.
He's hit a rut. So it's just such a strange season. Let's going back to our recap. First of all, interesting. I wasn't expecting the quickfire single elimination. I guess to get down, you need even number to do the competition, so they got to eliminate two. I guess is that the rationale
here?
Yeah,
I'm guessing so. And I felt so bad because Joe Flam, right off the bat, says how he's feeling good. He's got the momentum coming into this. And then, man, Kevin, if we've learned anything in sports is that momentum isn't real. I mean, I remember I did a big story for the ESPN, the magazine, about baseball playoffs. And the hottest teams actually underperformed compared to the coldest teams going into the MLB playoffs. You would have think the opposite. But in the NBA too, the last 10 games of the season correlates less with how well you do in the postseason compared to the first 10 games, which are like 6 months earlier. Like, there is no momentum nearly as much momentum as people think. It's just kind of a tidy narrative that we do in our brains. But Joe Flam just was coming off his first victory on the show, and then he's out. I feel like that's happened a couple times this season where Tyler felt like he didn't immediately get eliminated after his first elimination challenge, but it's pretty remarkable when you look at it that Joe Flam, I think that's why Fati was brought to tears just all of a sudden, is because it was all of a sudden, you know, the quick fire elimination challenge, but God bless him for doing the risotto.
Well, all right, so a couple of things. Let's get into the anatomy of his loss. And the first was to get on the chopping block. He doesn't roast the radishes sufficiently, right? They just don't get enough time in the oven.
Yeah.
And it leaves them either whether it's a little stiff or they're not sufficiently caramelized, as he suggested. And it was swimming in that sauce, and you could see that sauce. That was some Midwestern sauce, man. That was not a dish I would recognize from California. There was a lot of white goop on that plate, and it was noted. So then he gets thrown to the elimination, kind of sudden death, with Joe and Chris, also for overdressing his crudeau, is in the so we literally are looking 10 minutes into an episode. We are contemplating losing either Joe Flam, Joe Sasto, or Chef Chris, which is just in and of itself remarkable.
Yeah,
Chris kind of escapes, and then the two Joes proceed to cook absolute terrible. And, of course, Joe Flam falls victim to one of the oldest curses in Top Chef, the great risotto curse. Risotto is a Top Chef killer. One can remember John Tessar, remember the chef from Dallas and, mm-hmm. and Top Chef's him. He goes home for risotto. Top Chef Stats, whose creator is going to be on the show very shortly in the next few minutes, counts 5 eliminations by risotto. You might even remain a non-elimination bad risotto. Jeremy in season 13, Restaurant Wars, cooked, quote, the worst risotto in Top Chef history, I think according to Tom Colicchio. But he didn't go home because the problems in the front of the house were more epic. The only good risotto I can remember on Top Chef is a Mars uni risotto in the season 13 finale. Though he did not win season 13, Amar's risotto, I think, won that round, if I remember correctly. It was, I do remember because sea urchin risotto to me is kind of the perfect food.
Yes.
But so how terrible is it that Joe Flam falls victim? And it's not even a real risotto. It's a cauliflower risotto. So he didn't even get the pleasure of trying and failing at the actual dish. He has to go with that cauliflower ersatz risotto, but becomes, I believe, the sixth chef to be lost to a risotto.
I mean, and it was Kinch, the guest judge's, like, signature dish, right? You're, like, going against Allen Iverson and trying to cross him over. You know, that's not how you do things, especially with the curse of the risotto. You don't bring in a cauliflower risotto on Top Chef in general, but certainly not as bringing it with the judge, that's his signature dish.
See, I got to tell you, if I'm in that cauliflower substitution, here I am playing armchair quarterback. These chefs are unbelievably brilliant, and I'm sitting here. I can't even believe I'm doing this. I just got to execute a good cauliflower couscous. I know it's easy. Mm-hmm. I know it's facile, but just make it taste good. You're not going to go home. It's to me, like, because I did that cauliflower. I shaved it with a microplane, or just actually, no, I take that back, with a regular grater a few weeks ago. And it is actually so, so easy. So you go with the other components. You let you take a small hit for the cauliflower. Oh, cauliflower couscous, that's so easy. Yeah, okay, it is easy. But I'm not going to serve dog food is the upside there. I'm playing Monday morning quarterback, but that would be my thing. Meanwhile, a couple other fun little notes I have from the quick fire. Bruce is going to start doing a cavatelli. And Padma comes in with the basically – might as well have been the equivalent. Is this Top Chef or Top Pasta? Because all Bruce has been doing for the better part of a fucking month, man, is pasta. You know why? Because he's one of the best pasta makers I've ever witnessed. I mean, you and I have been treated to his pasta.
Yes.
And
it was so funny when Padma was like, really? Another pasta? And he goes, yeah, I was thinking about doing another pasta, but I decided to go with pasta.
And it's still pasta, she says.
Yeah, she's like, yeah, that's pasta. And he's like, you're right. You're right. Touche.
So it's just very funny. So there's a little bit of that. It was just a very tumultuous first 30 minutes. I mean, just no one cooked all that well. So there were only two chefs on the top of the original floral arrangement.
What did you think about the floral quickfire?
Edible flowers are interesting. I mean, there's a farmer at the farmer's market at Hollywood Farmer's Market on Sundays where I go every week that sells these lovely things. I mean, it's far above my pay grade in terms of working with using the aroma. I mean, I've always been somebody who's enjoyed a dessert with like hibiscus or lavender. Like I do like that sort of aromatic dessert. But I mean, I think it's a really interesting challenge, and it provided both a sand trap, so to speak. I mean, you have to work with this stuff. You have to figure out, well, do I need to not just work with it, but actually incorporate the aroma? Am I going to penalize for not doing it? Can I just use it for presentation? I mean, I like the challenge. It clearly snuck up on them, but yeah. I mean, that quick fire eliminate, I just think it is rough to eliminate somebody.
I know.
In a quick fire. And I know they got to get the numbers down and do a even number competition, but man, I mean, to watch Joe Flam just absolutely get, I mean, as he said, to pull the rug, I mean, the guy won. We're talking to, I mean, we're listening to our friend Hershey Hash basically saying, if there's one person I would, from this cast, I would hire tomorrow, it would be Joe Flam. Look at him at the top of the at the front of the house. Look at him, you know, essentially play error-free ball, as I've been saying all season, and he comes up with two massive errors in about 7 minutes of TV time.
There's no such thing as momentum. Someone on Twitter hit us up and said, "Man, your guests, it's like getting the KOD." And in Miami, living in Miami for 6 years, KOD means something entirely different than what this person was mentioning. KOD in Miami is the King of Diamonds, and that's a strip club that I think Lil Wayne frequents quite a bit. But it is not our guests. It's bringing on people from Top Chef is not the King of Diamonds. It is the Kiss of Death. Because Hershey said on the show that he was going to be his pick to be the chef of his restaurant if he could pick anybody. And then the other person that we had on that show last week was Fatima. So I think a little bit of this, and Daryl Morey says this about the Ringer curse. There's something on the internet right now in the NBA called the Ringer curse, which is, in other words, the plexiglass principle by Bill James, which is there is no sophomore slump for rookie of the years. It's just a regression to the mean. So people are going to overachieve and then be on the cover of the Madden game or the cover of Sports Illustrated. There is no such thing as a curse. It's just we're inevitably going to fall back down to earth after having, you know, been on the Ringer. They profile you on ESPN because simply you're probably overachieving and you're doing way better than expected, and therefore you're on the cover of Sports Illustrated. So I think that's what's going on here. Is maybe it's not a, I'm defending ourselves here, Kevin, and maybe not very convincingly, but I feel like Fatima was brought on the show in part because she's awesome and she's the fan favorite, but also because she was doing pretty well. She was doing great on the show.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know with this particular, I don't know that Joe overachieved last week. I don't think he regressed to the mean. I think this might be an outlier performance. I mean, I think the difference is
true.
Here, a sophomore season is exactly a season. I mean, this was two at-bats. I mean, this is essentially one game. Do we think that the elimination quickfire spooked them insofar as I felt like the final event, the Super Bowl, let's cook for the football heroes and some of their fans, they went very conservative? I mean, because I felt like it was a really disappointing. I think what we learned from Tom Colicchio is there was not a lot of good food this week. There was just not a lot of good food on that show this week. And I'm just trying to kind of get to the root of what happened. And I wonder if there's something about, did they get spooked by the quickfire, which led to very bad conservative decision-making in the main challenge. So Carrie won the quickfire, as we mentioned, and then she gets to choose. There are going to be three teams of two for the general challenge. She gets to pick, and she picks Chris. Were you surprised, Tom?
Well, I'm gonna bring in our friend here, friend of the program. This is a surprise, but I actually accidentally added her to the conversation, and here she is. Lynn,
accidentally added her to the conversation.
I was searching for your name, Lynn, to add her to this conversation, and sure enough, here she is. So why not just bring you in right as we're analyzing the elimination challenge from last night? Lynn from TopChefStats.com, the greatest site on this green earth.
Oh my
Welcome
God!
To the show,
Lynn.
Thank you. I'm so excited.
Lynn, I love your website. Hey, by the way, I have already alluded to it once this episode. Thanks to you, I knew exactly that five contestants have been eliminated to risotto.
Yes.
Now, that is not... Now, have you upped... Oh, six. See?
Six now.
You updated the site.
Yep.
You, no way.
On the wings of doves, you update the site. Look at this. Eliminated for risotto, six. Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
And technically, if you... So I don't count this as part of Top Chef, but the qualifying rounds for Top Chef Texas, Chaz actually got eliminated for risotto too, but since it wasn't the like main part of the show, I didn't count it. But so yeah, six total.
Can I ask you a question, Lynn?
Yeah.
And not to treat you like a freak or anything. Did you have that at instant recall? Is it like the way that Tom and I, just because we cover the, like we can actually, we know specific things that happened in game four of the NBA finals in 2014?
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty good. I think I can allude to most episodes. I know most people's names still. There is a lot that I would need to look up, but I'm pretty good at recalling everything.
Okay, so Lynn, can you tell us a little bit and our listeners just how this little passion project became a website, and was this something you've been tracking all along by hand at home, and then you're like, you know what, I'm gonna make a beautiful website with infographics and it, like, is this what you do for a living? Because this seems way too good to just be like, oh, this is a hobby.
Yeah. So I do web design and development for my job,
okay,
and I
good.
Like
that
to
makes me feel better. Okay.
Oh, good. Yeah. So I like to do these little side projects just for fun, and you know, I've been watching Top Chef just, you know, since it came on for what, like 12 years now, and I love it. And my husband is actually like super into sports and can, like you guys, like name off all the stats and like this specific game 35 years ago, you know? And like, I thought, you know, the only thing that I have like that is Top Chef. And so it's just, it lends itself well to infographics and things like that. So I thought, hey, it'd be really neat to kind of track the patterns that, you know, happen. Like they started quoting them in the show, like, oh, you know, if you win the first elimination challenge, you like your chances are higher of winning the show and things like that. So
RIP Tyler. Yep.
Yeah. Bummer. But yeah, so I went back through all of the episodes essentially and started this huge spreadsheet of just like keeping track of all of these different stats and compiling and kind of analyzing things. And then I made the site.
Are you a big food person as well?
I mean, I like food, but I'm not a cook. I like eating, but I'm kind of one of those people that like I could eat like cheap food or like really fancy gourmet food, and I don't really have any preference.
Gotcha.
But I just for some reason I'm just like, you know, I'm in love with this show and I like love the format, and it has inspired me to like go try different types of food and to try cooking. And I'm actually pretty good with like food trivia now, you know, learning all the ingredients and stuff like that. So
I have a question for you. I'm testing your knowledge right now because I just looked this up on my own spreadsheet and I'm curious. Adrian right now has not won a single elimination challenge through 9 episodes. Who is the last person to do that on Top Chef, to go through 9 episodes, 9 challenges, and not have a single victory?
Oh man, the last one.
All right, the fact that you haven't, this isn't a total like easy answer for you makes me feel better. Again.
Okay.
But can you recall someone like Adrian to just kind of hang out through in the middle throughout the entire season?
So one jumps out at me, but it was a while ago. But Kevin Spraga from DC, I think he went a long, and he eventually won, but he went a long time without winning.
Yeah.
Or at least he didn't win very many. But, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, so I guess here's the answer, at least in my tracking. The last person to do this was Sheldon in last season, was high in high, low, high, high. And then he won next week's episode. Sheldon did it last season. Amar, Kevin, you mentioned Amar recently.
Right.
Amar in season 13 won the 10th elimination challenge, so next week's elimination challenge with your uni. Was it the uni risotto, you think?
I think uni risotto was in the finale. It was one of his four courses.
Is that right?
So I don't think he won with the risotto. I think he just he won like the round, like the second course.
Yeah.
You know how like in, when they do the finals, they do like it's kind of there's an unofficial who won the appetizer, who won the pasta course, or who won the second course. That was that kind of thing. I don't think he won a round, a full round for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Lynn, this was kind of shocking to see Joe Flam go from winning to out with a sudden death quick fire. Is that a common thing in Top Chef to win and then be out in a is that a first, do you think?
No, that has definitely happened before. I don't have that stat in there, but I should add it. But yeah, it's kind of the thing they've talked about before where like it's just episode to episode and it's not really kind of cumulative. And so, yeah, there definitely have been instances where people are, they win and then the next day they lose.
So were you just like shaking when he said, I'm going to do a risotto?
I mean, yeah, it's always risky. I think it's funny because there are a lot of other things that people get eliminated for like that. Like more frequently, but risotto, I think all the judges are just very opinionated about it too. And so it's always a big deal when someone does risotto. And I think it's an easy dish to mess up probably.
Yeah. When he was like, yeah, I'm going to do cauliflower risotto. I was just like, oh, like Joe, don't do it. Don't do
it. I know.
But then I was looking at Chris and Joe Stash and being like, man, they can't get eliminated either.
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, noodle, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like, yeah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with the plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
Like, that's going to be really sad. So
yeah, this last episode, I was pretty bummed about both the eliminations. So
we're getting into, and you can join us here, we're getting into the elimination challenge. They do the tailgate with the football players coming back and with 300 people. Kevin's theory is that they were kind of thrown off by the sudden death quickfire and just kind of thrown off their game. Were you surprised at how poorly they did on their dishes?
You know, I was, because I think those types of events are usually fun, and so people tend to just bring a little bit more enthusiasm to what they're doing. So yeah, I think the sudden death quickfire put them in a weird, funky mood. But there also tends to be like a dip in the season at some point, you know, and I think that maybe we're just there.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a fatigue factor, kind of the grind of the season. I mean, I mentioned that Joe Sasto's cooked 6 crappy dishes in a row, which is pretty extraordinary. I also think there's sort of this populism thing where they get kind of caught up with, oh, it's a bunch of football players and fans. And because, I mean, look, these are people who have, by and large, you know, do very high level cooking, right? I mean, look at Adrian, look at what Joe Sasto's doing on a weekly basis. Look at Fatima wants to do with just flavor profiles and cook South Asian food in this setting. And then I think everybody gets to the Super Bowl tailgate and it's like, we got to do chili or ribs we need to make sure it's dumb enough for these fans. And I don't criticize it. I mean, I think there is a proper instinct, whether it's Fatima to do nachos or whoever to kind of do that brand of food. When I kind of just wonder, I thought kind of Bruce had it correct, which is, okay, to the extent that we need to have a certain type of accessibility to the food because it's a Super Bowl party, it's meat. Okay, but at least I can just do meat, and I'll do a little pickled beets or some sauce or whatever. But I think, like, the nachos to me, obviously I'm heartbroken about Fatima because, A, it's my last contestant. B, I'm just a huge fan. I still feel like we haven't seen her do, like, just absolutely transcendent cooking that she's capable of. She does solid cooking on a week-in, week-out basis, but I think nachos are just impossible for 300 people. I mean, when I saw her put those blue chips in a grocery cart, the blue chips that you buy at Whole Foods or wherever your grocery store is, I mean, just the sheer fact that you're creating a dish that's going to rely on pre-packaged chips tells you everything you need to know, which is don't do it. I don't care if you're putting lentils on or the achiote sauce or marinade with the chicken or the peach habanero salsa or everything else. Like you're relying on food that you didn't make. And now you're just putting stuff on chips.
Yeah, Lynn, that's got to be pretty high on the list of don'ts on Top Chef, is to have a pre-made ingredient, like a pre-made, pre-cooked ingredient that you buy at Whole Foods on your dish, right?
Yeah, totally. Like, I'm thinking just off the top of my head, like, Kwame did those frozen waffles. Mm-hmm. Although Sheldon did frozen waffles once and fared okay. And I'm actually thinking about Dale from Miami, the Elk Slod Challenge, where he bought, powdered potatoes.
Yeah.
But actually, like,
that.
He was on the top that week, and so I think it depends. I think
so maybe
in
that's
general,
a myth.
Yeah.
Did you say that's a myth in the myth category, that if you bring in some store bought ingredients, that it's actually not going to be hurting you?
I think it is. I think you're just setting yourself up to be criticized by Tom. I think he just doesn't like that, and so you really do have to, like, use that ingredient, like, creatively, or it has to just not hinder the dish at all. And so, yeah, I think it's a risk, and I don't know.
Yeah, I want to reiterate, it's not even so much that, oh, those chips aren't good. I'm sure those chips are delicious. I mean, I'll eat Pringles every day if you let me. It's not about, I think it's more just that
okay, you're one of the, you know, few thousand best chefs in America by virtue of being on this show. And so there's added value to being an exceptional chef. The minute you can do something, in other words, if I go up against Fatih, or for that matter, I go up against Chris when he had immunity and he used prepackaged rolls, and if we both put that in our grocery cart, that person has no advantage over me, right?
Yeah.
Like, and so it's just a matter of you're not accessing your talents when you come in with that thing. But I don't know. I just felt like, first of all, were you guys surprised that Kerry picked Chris? I wasn't, only insofar as I feel like the Super Bowl challenge was sort of his wheelhouse.
Yeah, Chris is, yeah, I think that was a big thing. And I actually, I don't know about the editing choices there, where I think they were the only couple in the confessionals. Is that, am I wrong?
No, the others were too. I remember Fatima and Bruce were bantering about Taylor Swift. Do you remember that part?
Oh.
Going to see Taylor Swift at the stadium.
Yeah, so that was my bad. I thought that they were showing us the winners there, that there was a little bit of a slip by them, but I'm wrong, I guess. Lynn, you're great. Lynn is the best. I didn't think that Chris was the knockout choice. The thing about Kerry, though, is her aw shucks attitude. She doesn't really show her hand very much. She's very unpredictable. So I don't know who her logical choice would be as her partner, but Chris is definitely someone who is A, been a high performer on the show, and B, is such a football nut and an outwardly football nut. I thought that was a smart choice by Kerry.
Yeah, I think Kerry has shown in the last two episodes that she's good at picking who to be on her team. I was actually worried because this is a stat that's not on the site, but if you are the first to pick your team in Restaurant Wars, you're way more likely to lose Restaurant Wars.
Oh my and,
really?
Whoa, yeah. Can we so, get into that? Oh, yeah.
So there are 11 Restaurant Wars where teams were picked, like dodgeball style, right? Two of them were the other ones. Two were a knife block. One was men versus women. And then one, there was no winner of Restaurant Wars, which was season two. But of the ones where you picked your team, 8 out of 11, if you picked your team first, you lost.
Wow.
Yeah. Your
teams that are first picks are 3-8 in Restaurant Wars. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. So first to choose has been a disadvantage for most teams.
What do you think that is? You think that's a judge's a bias of the judges being like a harsher to those teams, or do you think there's a certain it can't be that. What do you think is behind that, Kevin?
Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. Is it you the heart wants what the heart wants, but actually there's a more, you know. You want to, you know what it might be? It might be the LeBron or thing, like season one of the Heat. Like, you want to play with your friends? No, actually, you shouldn't be playing with your friends. Mm. You should be playing with people about whom you're just passionate. Yeah, or push you or compliment you who aren't your buddies, but actually just I always say, like, Adrian, I think, is a really good Restaurant War partner. And, not somebody anybody would have thought to pick. But maybe that's it. It's just like you think you want to work with your friends. Actually, you don't want to work with your friends.
Yeah. I think that a big part of it is the people that do the picking that have won have picked people for specific roles already. So Kerry was like, oh, Bruce can be back of house and Joe Flam can be front of house. So she knew who would be good in those roles. And the other two where that instance happened was Melissa in Boston. And so she picked Doug to be executive chef, and she picked Adam to be front of house. And then the other one was Stephanie in Chicago. And her time, she actually got to pick her entire team from the get-go.
Yeah.
And she lost?
No, she won. Those are the ones that have won.
Yep. And maybe that's it, is you got to think of, when everything's front of house, which is just such a specific skill set that either you either do or don't, but that comes naturally or doesn't come naturally. What's your favorite stat on your whether it's on your site or one you have, and what is your absolute favorite?
So this one isn't as much a stat and more just like a fun kind of thing that fans can laugh about, but there's a section on the site that is, this is Top Chef, not, and then a blank. And then it breaks down per season, like what people have said.
Lynn,
and so, like,
I have a text message from Kevin last night texting me, this is Top Chef, not Top Pasta.
it was sort of my interpretation of Bruce.
Yes, totally. Because, and someone should say that, not Top Polenta or something like that.
Yes.
I love your site. By the way, for the folks who are listening who are like, call out the site is topchefstats.com. topchefstats.com.
So let's read through them. This is Top Chef, not Top Sous Chef, Top Sommelier, Top Captain, Top Waiter, Top Cook, Top Line Cook, Top Pussy, Top Scallops.
Wait, what the hell was this? Is not Top Chef, not Top Pussy.
So Fabio said that, actually. I think it was kind of like an outtake, but they showed it.
In reference to who? Like, Stefan? What?
You know, I don't remember that, though. But I remember it was Fabio.
This is Top Chef, not a butt-rubbing contest, a wet t-shirt contest, fun and games, and hot air balloons, culinary boot camp vacation, a housewives cooking competition, a popularity contest, a personality contest. And shockingly, none of these have been repeats, right?
There are, I mean, yeah, so these are just the seasons where they were originally said, but like, I think this is not top sous chef has come up, especially a few times in the like earlier seasons when they were really looking for like people to step up as leaders.
Yeah. And popularity contest is probably up there too.
Yeah.
Just because so much of what Tom and I do is about sort of we delve through stats to really acknowledge who are the masters of the sport. Paul Key's reign during his season, I mean, just from, as somebody who has looked at these stats as carefully as you have, I mean, that's got just to be really impressive. I mean, we're talking about, I mean, relative to the other dozens and dozens of contestants, I mean, is it safe to say that was the most artful and dominant performance in the history of Top Chef?
Yeah, for sure. He has the most elimination wins overall and the most overall wins, like quick fires and elimination challenges.
Is that one season? He's only been on one season, right?
One season, yep. And I count them by season. So if you've been on multiple seasons, your like most wins is like per season.
Nine. What's the second most elimination wins?
Let me see. So elimination. Brooke.
Combined?
Oh, actually, it's no per season. So Brooke Gregory from Boston, Kevin Gillespie. Actually, there's a bunch, so it's five. So Kevin from Las Vegas, Kristen from Seattle, Richard Blaze from the All Star season, and then Stephanie from Chicago.
And those people had how many?
Five elimination wins.
So literally, then, Paul had nine. The next most ever in a season was five.
Five, yeah.
I mean, come on.
Paul had nine. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, that's just... That's sick. Anyway.
So, what is your feeling on this season? Can you give us a handicap on who you think has shown the most... the best chance of winning Top Chef? And are there certain traits that you look for after studying this entire series that certain contestants are exhibiting this season?
Sure. So I think Carrie is really high in my mind. She very early figured out how she needed to cook to do well. And now she's winning, you know, repeat challenges. And so I think she's doing really well. Same with Bruce. I think he struggled a little bit and now he's kind of like, okay, I need to be true to myself. But I think he also now needs to learn that he needs to stretch. They want to see creativity.
I think one thing I'm curious about is Bruce. He was in the team play. He was in the bottom three this week. When you're scoring these at home, are you frustrated by the guys who do really well, like cook that really nice sirloin steak, but get thrown in the bottom because of team play?
Yeah, I think it can be frustrating in some scenarios, but in most cases, I don't feel that frustrated because being a chef, as they say on the show, is a big part about working with others and leadership and, having vision. And a part of a team challenge is working with someone else and creating something together. And I think that's what happened with Bruce this time, is that they made two dishes And when the judges are looking for kind of cohesion or a collaboration and they don't get that, I think that reflects on the chef in a real world way.
Right, though they'll never really generally pay for it.
Yeah.
Like a perfect example, Adrian has been able to really... Adrian, to me, is an interesting contestant this season because she's so excellent technically. Mm-hmm. And it saves her time and again. If you can cook protein, and in her case, she's figured out the seasoning issue. Like, she wasn't going to go home last night. And it was in, yeah, she wasn't on the winning team, but they pretty much reasoned that, look, she got the, I think it's the guest judge, you know, the tenderness was there on the meat. And by and large, she cooks meat brilliantly. It's 2 weeks in a row where she's probably been the best, you know, execution chef when it comes to nailing the protein. She did the duck last week in Restaurant Wars, nailed it. And she, look, she didn't wow anybody with her ribs, but she's not going to go home for an exquisitely cooked rib, at least not yet. I mean, it will, I mean, ultimately when Adrian goes home, and she will go home, I don't think she's going to win the competition, it will be because the meat was well done, the meat was well cooked and lovely, but it just lacked a little flair. And that's ultimately, but it's interesting because I do,
yeah.
But I think she's even figured that out. I mean, clearly we haven't heard about that in weeks, right? Like no one has even said anything about bland food recently. I mean, she had this moment where she was humiliated, called for it. And clearly ever since then, there's been no issue with seasoning to the extent that she hasn't, you know, won. It's because, you know, maybe that needed to be directly on the grill or on the smoke rather than cooking in the liquid as she did last night, and she's a very conservative chef. I mean, that's the other thing with Adrian. That's a very conservative instinct, right? Which is first do no harm.
Yep.
And she's very much the Hippocratic chef oath is Adrian. First do no harm. Like make sure the protein is done correctly. And it might, whether it lacks seasoning or I don't get the full vivaciousness of it because it wasn't directly on the flame, which it wasn't. But yeah, to your point is that I do think selfishness does help in this game sometimes, which is, hey, if you see your partner going down a very worrisome path, and Bruce clearly saw the nachos as being problematic. He kind of retreated into his steak. He wasn't going to win, but he probably is not going to go home if he can nail the skirt steak, and he didn't. Last night's elimination, I was actually frankly surprised to see Fatima go home before Joe, given what we heard or saw. Like, I didn't realize the nachos were that bad, but apparently they got really soggy, as nachos do.
Yeah, if you're going to do nachos, you really got to nail it. And it seems like she either hasn't cooked nachos or she doesn't really understand the football tailgate, that it needs to be a little bit more elevated than that. I don't know. I think I don't think there were
nachos suck. I mean, I hate to say it, but nachos is not a good dish.
I'm Team Colicchio on this one. I love a good nacho.
But you love a good nacho. How do you make good nachos for 300 people?
Yeah, I think Bruce kind of knew that was going to be really tough.
Like the chips get all soggy, and then you don't. Or if the cheese has got to be that hot, and if it's not hot, it gets that lumpiness, that sort of that rubberiness. Like it's a terrible mass production dish. Terrible mass production dish.
Get out of here with that mass production dish. Get rid of the nachos.
No,
is nachos.
I love Fati.
We have Lynn, the historian here. Are nachos particularly worrisome?
It's not. It's Top Chef, not Top Nacho.
I'm trying to think of another nacho. I know that in season one, Dave did like a high end nacho, but I can't think of very many other nachos that have come across.
Season one, there wasn't even fire yet. They didn't even have they didn't even have convection ovens in season one. Season one, I have you know, was like taped in like 300 BC in a cave.
It does feel
like
pretty
in
old.
Samaria.
can we talk about Joe Stash and his germaphobe rant about basketball?
Oh, that was hilarious. as a germaphobe, I'm.
Kevin, have you ever heard that take before? I don't play sports
So I used to have Dodger season tickets, and I sat in the second level, so the Loge, second of four levels, and Dodger Stadium, especially during the day, is known for beach balls. So some fan will blow up a beach ball and then start bopping it, you know, and basically the whole thing is you just pop it over one section and keep it going as long as you can until an usher comes and takes it away and everybody boos and it's asinine, but people do it. And that's been the case in Dodger Stadium since I don't know, the beginning of time or whenever it started in Dodger Stadium. I always hated it. Not because, not just because I was a baseball purist. I just don't like to be bothered during the game. Like, I don't want to just get that thing. But also, I just used to call it an inflated booger. Because, like, what is a beach ball going around a stadium if not, like, just something that everybody's been, like, eating food with their hands at the game and then touching it, and there are lots of children, and children are just germ machines, and I just used to call it the booger. Because, like, it was gross to me, the beach ball. The number one reason I didn't want to touch that beach ball was what could possibly be on that thing. It was just disgusting. So I do kind of get that, but in terms of basketball, no. I never thought about a basketball as a plus, like, when you're out playing sports, I think you suspend the germophobia, because, like, you're in competition. Like, there's no germophobia when you're actually playing sports.
But and for a guy who works in a kitchen and is handsy with food, like, shouldn't you be over the whole germy thing?
No, I think actually it's because you work in the kitchen and you're in food, and chefs are actually pretty damn careful.
I guess the quote is, I'm not ashamed to say it. I don't like sports at all. Sports with balls? No. Especially basketball. Throw it on the ground and touch it again? Like, gross.
Sports with balls? No. Chefs with balls? Yes.
That was amazing. And I have never heard of this crystal thing. Lynn, do you know what this crystal thing is? Is this a thing?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I've heard of them tangentially, but never that specific, like, that people put them, like, in their pocket or anything like that.
Good. He's a good boy. He is a very good boyfriend, not to make fun of his girlfriend for believing in something asinine and superstitious.
Oh, man. Lynn, I want to ask you, the season in general, how do you feel about it? Just the arc, the contestants, have you felt better about the season as it's gone on? Or do you have to, like, watch the entire season like a movie before you can evaluate it? How do you feel about season 15?
I really like season 15. I think this one is a little bit different in that, especially until the last two episodes, like, the winners were really spread out. And so there wasn't a clear, you know, dominant person. And so that's fun to kind of see how everyone reacts to that. I like this one. I feel like there's a lot of really fun, memorable people on the show. I think that's what, like, makes it stand out for me season to season. I think there are some seasons where I think back and I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can name everybody, like, just off the top of my head, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I really like that. I think it's been fun. I think the challenges haven't been, like, as, like, weird as other ones. I like some of those, like the camping one, I think is cool. Like, putting them in a situation that's just like hard and they have to really be creative. I like challenges like that. So I haven't seen as many of those, but I really like this one.
What is your favorite challenge? Mine, I think, is the one where you have to go blindfolded and pick up where the previous contestant left off. I find that one so fun.
Yeah. That one is cool. The tag team cook-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like those. I think my favorite is the blind taste testing.
I was going to say that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I think that's just so fun. And I think it humbles everybody a lot, you know, and I think it's neat to see. It's a different skill.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing moment. When they go through, and sometimes they're like, I have no idea what this is. And you're screaming, it's edamame!
Hey, so let me ask you a question, Lynn. Only because you've probably thought kind of more critically about this than anybody. I mean, just giving your love for the show and clearly your retention of it all. If I were to bring you in as a consultant for season 16 and the producer said, hey, we need to shake things up a little bit. I mean, this is a great show and it's an Emmy Award winning show and everybody loves it. And, you know, we want to introduce some new wrinkles. We want to refine the competition. If there are inefficiencies in the competition, we want to eliminate them, and or if they're unfair, if there are biases or unfairnesses or whatever. But we want to. How can we improve? Is the easy way of saying. What would you say in terms of the structure?
Oh, you know, I think I don't know. It's nice that it's consistent, and so it kind of makes comparing season to season easy. And, you know, a winner went through a lot of the same stuff that other winners.
You're such an empiricist. It's so funny.
But yeah, I think I would like to see maybe switching it up to, like, bracket style, or maybe just, like, for part of it, or maybe you cumulatively gain points instead of it being, you know, episode to episode, where the work you do early on or later. You know, it's just, I think that would mix it up a little bit. You know, Top Chef Duels, which is a spinoff, they did it bracket style, and that was kind of neat. It paired up people that were similar and people that were really different, and put kind of difficult challenges on them. And that was cool to see how each of them would respond when you're competing directly against someone else, you know?
I mean, it is interesting. We just take it as an article of faith that it's what have you done for me lately, right? Like Joe Flam can literally be on top of the world, and he gets absolutely, he doesn't get to bring anything. The only thing that his wins get him is confidence and maybe a slight intimidation factor, or maybe there's a bias he's with the judges knowing that he's a really good chef and we won't kick him off if all things are equal. But you're right. Like in Tom's system in our fantasy draft or in our fantasy season is, I mean, Tom rewards points over time, right? I mean, that's the system you came up with, Tom. But like, you're right. It's funny. We don't think about that. Like you can win 8 weeks in a row, and if you were Joe Flam this week, it didn't matter a damn bit. And right. There are very few competitions, whether it's a 4-day golf tournament or basketball standings or anything else, where you get absolutely, you don't get to bring your past success in to you. The only thing I can think of is again a playoffs, right? Where it doesn't matter if you swept the first three series, if you get to the NBA finals, none of that matters or whatever. But yeah, that's interesting. I would love, a scoring system would be really interesting, just sort of a standings board. I mean, I think the limit, and I mean, I guess the way you could do it is, well, it's tough, right? Because you're not going home for the worst dish. Who are they sending home? The person this week who happens to have the fewest points at the end of the week, who, by the way, cooked a pretty good meal, and that would be the argument against it, I guess. But I like what you're saying, and I'm with you, though. It's funny, as much as I think there could be fun reforms and lend some intrigue to a new season, I do love the fact that you know when eight people are left, there's going to be restaurant wars, right? Like, that's one of the great moments of watching a Top Chef season, is knowing, oh, we're almost down to eight, or that there are certain, at this point, rites of passage to a season, and that kind of connect it to the legacy of the show.
Yeah, definitely.
I wonder, like, in the NBA, you're rewarded for your regular season performance by having a better seed in the brackets. I wonder if they could do it like that, like in the last few episodes, the winner of the most elimination challenges gets some sort of an advantage going forward. So it kind of reflects the NBA season that doesn't too much reward the regular season, but also gives you something to accumulate those wins. It gives you something to keep that momentum going. So it's not so goldfishy where there's no memory from episode to episode. But yeah, Carrie, I'm struggling with the idea. Like, I wonder if Carrie, if you were to redraft, would Carrie be the number one pick? I feel like I would go Bruce or Chris, interestingly enough. I don't know, maybe that's just me not believing in Carrie because she's the hometown favorite, and she's also like, she doesn't seem too competitive about things, and she doesn't seem as diehard serious about this competition, but maybe that's just me. What do you guys think is the most likely, if you're going to pick a number one draft, who would be the most likely winner, Kevin?
Me right now?
Yeah, because you might have to redraft. We don't know what we're going to do here. I mean, you have no more chefs left.
I'm of two minds, which is recency bias and everything else. Like, if I thought that Joe Sasto was the most creative, like, in other words, there are now only, what, there's six chefs left? Five, right? Five plus whoever's going to come out of the last chance, right? We're at five now. I mean, so part of me is, it's a hard one for me, because on one hand, okay, Joe Sasto was the most creative chef until like six dishes ago. So why wouldn't he be now? Bruce, ironically, I had the chance to get double points or whatever, and I punted it with you, and it turned out that like my initial instincts way back when we were reading things were correct. So Bruce is still very much, but I also don't think Bruce is a born Top Chef candidate. Like, he might be the best chef in the show, but you know, by his own admission, like, hey, the time, you know, budgeting of time or contingency is not his thing, right? He is a comfort chef, and he does rely. So I don't know, like, whoever's left of the five, maybe, I don't know. And then with Carrie, does the safety is the, hey, playing within yourself and doing toast and kale salads, is that, but that's the kind of thing that can help you avoid elimination and win a quick buyer. Is it the kind of thing that can help you produce like the best four course meal that you're going to need as you get closer and closer to the finale? I mean, as we know, and I mean, Lynn, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like, am I correct that my imagination that as we get to the final five or four, there are many more eliminations that are Padma kind of mournfully saying, please bag your knives and go. I hate to do this because it was a really good dish, but we're down to the very best and now we're nitpicking over small grains of salt. And like, am I right that I think that many of the later eliminations are not sins of commission, but kind of sins of omission, or just you just happen to have the worst of five great dishes?
Yeah, I think that is pretty common where, you know, it comes down to like a grain of salt then, because everything's good.
By the way, how much was this week of please pack your knife and go? like the extremes of like, oh, yeah. Like, you know, like, please pack your knives and get out of here, you talentless.
They just said the two fan favorites, I feel like.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But she had two please pack your knives and goes. I hate to do this week.
Last question before you let you go, Lynn. What is your favorite season of Top Chef?
Oh, man. So I think probably Las Vegas. I think.
Remind me the number on that.
Six.
Ah. Okay.
So the Voltaggio brothers and Kevin and Jen Carroll.
By the way, really talented group.
Yeah. I thought that group. So the four of them, the top four, just dominated that season. And I thought that was really cool, just really high talent level. And that was the first season where they really started doing kind of like these high stake quick fires, like giving prizes out for different challenges. So I thought that was kind of where they're like, we're going to just start to be a little bit crazy now, you know? So I love Vegas. I'd say runners up are Texas. It was really fun. I loved Beverly. So I was like on Team Beverly. and then probably Boston. I thought May was just super cool.
I like May. May is one of my favorite chefs.
Yeah.
Kevin's just sucking up to her so that he can go to a restaurant.
So that's all I'm really all about here is I just want chefs to treat me really nicely. No, it's good. No, you're right about, you know, it's funny you say that about Vegas now that you mentioned it. I think it was the first season the show knew what it was, which is a classic. You know, I think early on, like the reality show economy was just like a lot of these shows were produced on a budget. I mean, and it took a show a while to kind of garner the sort of sponsorship commitments and to really be able to kind of roll out some money and really, you know, you kind of shoot the moon. And you're right. I think that was kind of the moment when, like, everybody who was into food in America realized this is a great show and sort of, you know, kind of took to it and it became, like, you knew Top Chef was going to kind of be here to stay and kind of it established itself. And to your point, they kind of started pulling out some stops and really doing stuff.
Lynn, thank you so much. Everybody, topchefstats.com. It is the greatest thing.
It's so much fun.
Pun
thank
food
you.
Intended. Thank you so much. Enjoy the weekend. Kevin, let's sign off.
This is Pack Your Knives.